Good morning. Welcome to each of you and greet you in Jesus' name. So if you faint when it's tough, your strength is small. I think I have a pretty small strength, and I was not to get under Ernie's subject. I'll let that one for him, but I have maybe a twist on it here, is that probably one of the things that makes my strength small is when I depend on myself too much. And in that way, the message that I was thinking of this morning maybe ties into it a little bit. So a question for you. Is there anything in your life that bends you out of shape or unsettles you? And if it is, what? Just identify it for yourself. I don't need to know. But I had somebody from Wisconsin text me a while ago and give me a verse to preach on up there here in a couple weeks. And so that was on my mind. I decided just to share at least a version of it here. And in thinking of that version, so what bends you out of shape or unsettles you? I don't know. Maybe y'all don't have those days. I think sometimes I have too many of those days where life just sort of looks dark and meaningless. I don't know. You ever have those? Hopefully not a lot, but where it almost takes more energy to get out of bed than what it looks like you're going to accomplish for the day. What's the use? But hopefully we still do. It's not saying you should stay in bed just because you feel that way. And I know a lot of that's tied to feelings, so I got to dance with those too, but work around that. I really appreciated, I just say this way, Wes gave us a wonderful introduction to what I was actually thinking about in the verses he read there in Psalm 121. So probably initially when I started thinking on this subject, I probably, unfortunately maybe, my first thoughts were on maybe a pet peeve I have. And that is the thing that I see happening so often of what I call speculation, sharing of speculation and rumors. And it seems the last few years there's been things happening in the world scale and in Mennonite circles that brought those out by the boatload. Think of Sasha Cross, Linda Stolzfus, then COVID and all the politics of such and this. And, you know, it's just a lot of opinions and a lot of things and a lot of probably even well-meaning people, I think, expressing just sheer falsehoods even sometimes. And, it's pretty confusing if you let yourself get wrapped up in it. That can be one way. So in thinking about that kind of situations, the ones I mentioned, what is a Christ-like response to troubling times, such as any of those? Later I thought, well, maybe I was looking too much. I'm not saying those things don't unsettle me at all. I think they can. Maybe a little different tack than some people, but later I thought, well, maybe I was thinking too much of others and their struggle. I think maybe my problem is just feeling burned out in doing God's work. I don't know. So I know that some things are good for me to do, and I know that God wants me to fight spiritual battles, but finally you try and you work and you work and you think you, sometimes you think you got somewhere and then you look back and you're like, did I make any headway at all? And it just sort of swamps you. I don't know. Maybe you don't have that. That's probably where it hits me harder. Or, and just cheerfully keeping on doing things that seem sort of useless. Maybe in relating to people and things when it just seems like your best just isn't good enough. So those are some of the thoughts I have in the back of my mind as I get into the rest of this. Let's just start off by thinking about 13 men. 13 men visiting a huge building. And these 13 men went to this huge building, maybe we should call it a compound campus, was probably a word we would use today. It was one central building, but also had other parts to it. This campus they were at was like 14 acres, so it's a pretty big place. I doubt it was all under one roof necessarily, but it was all dedicated, all the 14 acres, to worship. And these men had gone there likely for that purpose, but as they had done their thing and they were standing there watching others, first they started watching the people, and you know, that's, if you've ever done that in a big place with a lot of people, that's interesting. Then after a while they shifted from the people to the building. And some of them were marveling about this building and how well it was put together and how vast it was and how amazing it was. The one place I read, now I can't prove this and I have a bit of skepticism about it, but you can at least think about it. He claimed that some of the stones in this building were 60 feet across. I don't know how they moved the rock like that, but it'd be pretty hard on equipment today even. So this was an old building. So anyway, so they were there standing, talking about this building. And this building had been in the process. Various parts of this campus had been built. The whole thing to the place it had gotten to the day they were looking at, it had taken 500 years roughly. Thousands upon thousands of people had contributed time, effort, and the best that they had in money and in ornaments. And this building was, I would probably say, my way of saying it anyways, the pride of those who followed that religion, and a focal economic and cultural monument, not only for this religion, but also for the ruler of that area. You know, as these 12 of the men were standing there just amazed at this building, a little bit like I am when I see some buildings. And then the 13th, though, he had a little different take on it. You know, as the 12 of the 13 men marveled at the grandeur and prided themselves in the fact that they were part of a movement whose practice had achieved such greatness, the 13th man said this. He said, "Of all the things you see in this building here and all the glory of it, there's coming a day when not one of these stones will be left on top of another one." Not one on top of another one. Well, that was sort of startling because they were just being amazed by this thing. Now they're being told it's going to be ruined. So the 12 asked a question, said, "When will this happen and what are some of the things that will lead up to it?" You probably know who I'm talking about now is Christ and his disciples. So can you tell me real quick, what's the sign of a true prophet, anyone? What's the sign of a true prophet? There you go, pretty simple, right? So let's just look at how Jesus' words came true in this case. Now before we get into looking at the prophecy and the actual happening more, I'd like to maybe introduce you to a phrase. Probably some of you know it. Maybe some of the rest of you don't. How many are familiar with the term dual fulfillment prophecies? Dual fulfillment prophecies. Anyone? Not something we often probably. I think you probably know what I'm talking about. So a dual fulfillment prophecy. Well, y'all know what a prophecy is, right? It's a forecast of something's going to happen. We have weather people that try to be prophets, some successful and other times not. So a true prophet is somebody that forecasts that something will happen. Sometimes they give a place, sometimes they give a time, and sometimes they don't. But that this will happen at a certain time or place with certain results. And if it happens, they're a true prophet. If they don't, they're a false prophet, according to Scripture. So I'll just give you one. Moses, in Leviticus chapter 26, gave this prophecy to Israel. Leviticus chapter 26, 29. And it says, he's telling them what the blessings are if they serve God and the curses they will experience if they don't serve God. And he says, "If they don't serve God, then I, God, will walk contrary unto you also in fury. And I will chastise you 7 times for your sins. And you shall eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters shall ye eat." Cannibalism. So that was a prophecy, if you will, because it actually happened in 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 26. Remember when two ladies that ate the one child the one day and were planning to eat the other the next day, and then the one wouldn't do it. Lamentations 4:10 talks about it. So that happened at the destruction. Was that Samaria? Jerusalem. I think it was Samaria. It happened at the destruction there, but it also happened again after the time of Christ, in a time I want to speak of here soon. So it was a dual prophecy. You understand what I'm saying? It happened once, but it had a fulfillment again. And that's a fairly simple one. There's another one. We could go to, 1 Chronicles chapter 17, verse 10 through 15. There's a prophecy about God establishing the throne of David through Solomon. It hadn't happened yet. Solomon was not ruling, but he was saying what would happen in Solomon's time. But also, if you read those verses, it's also very clear that he's talking about more than Solomon. He's talking about Christ. So that's a dual prophecy as well, just to give you an example. So I want to look at a dual prophecy that Christ made here. Before we do that, let's get a bit of a timeline. I know some of you are not history buffs, and that's just fine, but I think it would still help your Bible reading to get some years on some of these things, so maybe I'll do that a bit more than I used to. So Solomon built his temple. Now, these dates, you can find different commentaries that will put it different times, so I'm not being dogmatic about this. But Solomon's temple was built around 957 B.C., so let's see. Does anybody tell me what BC means? Before Christ. So if I got 957 and now something is newer, which way does the you reach New Year's, what's the date then? One less, right? So 956 in that case. So Solomon's temple was completed more or less around 957 B.C., so we're going to count from 957 years before Christ. Actually, I'll get to that in a minute, moment. So it was destroyed. I don't know if I want to write all this, but it was destroyed in, again, there's probably some variation, around 586 B.C. So not quite 400 years. Israel, some of the Jews were allowed to come back around 538 with the goal of building the temple by Cyrus the Great, is when they began second, so it's what they call the Second Temple. Now that was sort of a continuing process there, they weren't necessarily done. Basically, around 515 is when it was considered completed, so that's not that they were working at it each and every day that whole time. So let's just put second complete. Okay, then what's interesting about the Second Temple is if you would turn to Ezra chapter 3, verse 12, it says, "Those, and many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers who were ancient men that had seen the first house," meaning the first temple, Solomon's, "when the foundation of the first house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice." And if you keep reading there, it's sort of interesting time. So the younger people were terribly excited and were shouting for joy, and the old men were weeping because it was so different from what they had it. But anyway, sort of a side note on that. But so the second was built, but the second one was a very modest thing in comparison to what Solomon had built way back. Probably just mainly one building, a place to offer sacrifices and things. Now, that's 515 before Christ. Now, about, it's again some variation, so I'm just going to choose 15. Some say 25, some say 20, some say 19, some say 10. But right around 15 B.C., Herod the Great took it upon himself to revamp the whole temple site. And he actually doubled the size. He took it from about, let's see here. Before the temple, the campus, whatever you want to call it, was almost 17 acres. Herod expanded that and made it 35 acres pretty much. Cover 35 acres, and he redid everything. He left the Jews actually do all the temple work themselves, but he did the rest, and it was partly because it was sort of, I guess, his way of trying to be good friends with them, but also to make himself look good with Rome. So around 15 B.C., so Christ, actually, just to get this, this is a little bit off because Christ is generally considered to have been born 4 B.C., which is a little strange if you're talking Christ, but anyways. So Christ be born around 4 B.C., and then, let's see. Now, just if you decide to count this up on your own, just remember one thing. There was no zero, year zero. It went from 1 B.C. to 1 A.D. So there was no year zero. So then Christ would have, is generally considered to have been crucified around 3 A.D., which, if you know Spanish or anything, it's easy to remember what that means. It means after Christ, after Dios, which is Latin. So this was the crucifixion, it would have been in here. And then the temple was actually destroyed. Herod's temple, Jerusalem was pretty much wiped off, well, not completely, but wiped off the map at 70 AD. So 40 years after the crucifixion of Christ is when the Jews paid the price for what they did to him, pretty much. So it gives you a little bit of an idea there. Going into a little bit of the details here. So what the disciples were marveling at would have been this huge thing that Herod had helped complete. Roughly, it was a 10-year building project. And so Christ was in his ministry, so likely around 28 AD, let's say. 28. So, you know, it would have probably been completed about 35, 40 years as a new, pretty much a completely new thing. So it was still something special to the Jews at that time. Now, going to the destruction of Jerusalem, which I want to talk about a little bit, the Jews rebelled against Rome in AD 66. So it was 4 years before this. So the rebellion would have been 66 to 70. There was a number of things going on here. Why don't we just turn, open your Bibles to Luke chapter 21. The one of the verses that was given me is in here. Luke chapter 21, I want to read from 5 to 28. 5 to 28. So at first, Jesus and his disciples were in the temple watching the people, like I said. And we had that discussion about the widow that threw in her few pennies, whatever, and how Christ said it was as much as what the rich men were putting in. And then they shifted to talking about the building. So Luke chapter 21, verse 5. So just keep these things in mind as we read this. And some spake of the temple, I take it as some of the disciples, and some spake of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts. And he, Christ, said, as for these things which ye behold, the days will come in which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And they asked him, saying, Master, when shall these things be? And what sign shall there be when these things shall come to pass? And he said, take heed that ye be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and the time draweth near. Go ye not therefore after them, but when ye shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by or not yet. Verse 10, and he said unto them, nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines, and pestilence, and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven. But before all these things, they shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. And it shall turn to you for a testimony. Settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what you shall answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay or resist. And ye shall be betrayed both by parents and by brethren and kinsfolks and friends. And some of you they shall cause to be put to death. And ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. But there shall not an hair of your head perish. And I take that in a spiritual sense because he just told them they're going to be killed. Verse 19, in patience possess ye your souls. And then ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies. Then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them which are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be a great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And there shall be signs in the sun, and in the moon, and in the stars, and upon the earth, distress of the nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's heart failing them for fear, for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. So that's why I called that a dual prophecy. I'm not smart enough to tell you what is all the destruction of Jerusalem and what may be some future things, and I have no desire to be, disputational at all about it. It's just yeah, some people have their things of what's future and what's not, and I don't really want to get into that. Definitely some of this was about Jerusalem. Some seems to be about the future. So let's look at the Jerusalem part. How did this work out in history? So a couple things. After the time of Christ, it probably was starting around his time. There was a lot of unrest among the Jews. But so if he died at 30, somewhere between 30 and 66, a number of years before 66, there was a new group, I don't know if we should call them religious or political, they were somewhat both, of Jews that started up. They were called Zealots. And probably, I don't know, this is speculation on my part, I would guess that Paul would have been part of that if he wouldn't have got converted, just the kind of person he was, Zealots. I don't know, I was trying to, how can I describe Zealots to you? I was a little bit stumped, and then I thought of this slogan that we've been seeing the last number of years, America First or something like that. Well, Zealots would be Jerusalem and Jews first, undoubtedly. That's one way of describing them. The rest of the world could just go to crash about them. But they were all about Jews, all about Jerusalem, all about supposedly God, but not really, maybe. So that was the movement, and they were gaining more and more power. So in the Bible, we read about the Sadducees. The Sadducees were sort of the political power in the Jesus time. They were sort of laid back, easygoing, not very religious, didn't believe in angels, didn't really believe in afterlife. They were more concerned about getting along with Rome and keeping everything even keel. The Pharisees were more zealous, but they were all focused on the praise of men. So the Zealots would have probably sprung somewhat from the Pharisees, but they were more willing to put action to it, willing to rebel, just do what they needed to do. So that was one thing that was happening. Another thing that was happening is Nero. Nero died in around 69. So Nero would have been emperor up to this time. And he put a governor into Judea, over Judea. Pilate's time had been gone and probably a couple others by that time. But he put this other governor in. And the history book I read said he didn't vet him very well. I don't know what Nero did very well except take care of himself. So regardless, he put a man sort of like himself over Judea. And this man was supposed to be collecting taxes and stuff for Nero. And it seems like he was pretty much just doing whatever suited him, a little bit like Nero did. And he was running into trouble. And so one way he would try to cover up trouble is be real nasty to the Jews and stuff in an effort to get them to rebel so that it would look like he was justified in some of the carrying-ons he had. So that's some of the things he had coming together. Let's see. Then there was another thing that had happened that affected maybe the Christians more. Let's see, I don't have a year on that, do I? 4 years before the revolt. So 62, the Sanhedrin, using authority they actually didn't have, had condemned James the Just to death, which he would have been the first bishop, Christian bishop in Jerusalem. So that would have probably mean that this was James, the brother of Jesus. They condemned him to death in 62 and actually took him out and stoned him. And so the Christians were very unsettled by that whole thing and the persecution that followed that. So some of them were actually probably likely leaving at that point already. So now I'm going to shift. So the Bible's sort of quiet on the destruction of Jerusalem. It's likely that like Revelation at least would have been written afterwards, but it doesn't really mention it. So we turn to a couple other historians that are generally Adam Clark and some of those use some of these. So I hope I'm giving you credible information. There was an early church historian called Eusebius. He says this. He said, "It is very remarkable that not a single Christian perished in the destruction of Jerusalem, though there were many there when the Roman general Vespasian first surrounded the city. Had he persevered in the siege, he would have soon conquered it." So this is interesting. So now think back what Christ has said. He said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the army, think that its destruction is close. So this Roman general Vespasian came in there with the army. He actually completely surrounded it, cut it off, and he was getting ready for his final attack. So I should back up a little bit. In 66, the Jews rebelled, and these Zealots took over, and they thought they were doing pretty good. They actually chased the Romans out of Jerusalem and actually were controlling the country for a little ways around. And the Jews that had traveled to Rome told them, "You're crazy. This is not going to last. This terrible mistake," but they thought they were feeling pretty big there for a time. By 69, they had been driven back into Jerusalem, and he was there ready to finish him off, and Nero died. And so he actually had his army around. Like Christ said, he had his army surrounding Jerusalem. And when Nero died, he got a message that Nero was dead and that there was some fighting about who would be next emperor of Rome. So he actually pulled his army back from around Jerusalem so that he could go take care of that. He was actually selected as the next emperor. So he put his son Titus in control of this whole thing. And he ran off to Rome. So there was a brief time in 69. I'm not sure exactly what time, probably about fall of 69, where they were the Romans were sorting their stuff out and had pulled back, that anybody in Jerusalem could actually get out and leave. And all the Christians supposedly did, from what they know. So all the Christians left because of Christ's words here in Luke. Then by April, well, probably before Titus was working on it, but by the 1st of April of 70, Titus had it completely cut off. Now, the Passover is the beginning of April, so 3 days before the Passover, he completely surrounds the city, and he let people go in, but he wouldn't let anybody come out. And it was a tactical thing on his part, because he was trying to run them out of food. And so some people dispute this. They would say there was up to 1 million Jews in Jerusalem because of the Passover at that time. And if you came, he would freely let you go in, but he wouldn't let anybody come out. And it took him from April. They attacked soon after he had it surrounded and cut off. They left him have the Passover to try to get him penned up. Then he had him, it took him till September to actually totally get it wiped out. And what was interesting is during that time, I'm going to read from two historians. Of course, you know, some of you are familiar with Josephus and this Eusebius. Says, during the withdrawal, the Jewish followers of Christ heeded his warnings here in Luke and also given in Matthew, I believe, and fled. 3 days before the Passover, around the 1st of April, Titus surrounded Jerusalem. He continued to allow pilgrims into Jerusalem for the feast, but afterward he would not let them come out. This amplified the food shortage. It got so bad, Josephus writes, dove dung sold for a premium. Can you imagine buying dove pigeon droppings to eat? That'd be the best food you could buy. Well, it's interesting, these zealots, in trying to force God to help them, actually wasted a lot of food initially to try to prove that they had such confidence. So they ended up regretting that. And some people resorted to cannibalism. There's actually at least one instance of a mother eating her own baby. The best of friends wrestled with each other for even a grain of food. Others, mouths agape from hunger like mad dogs, staggered along, beating on doors like drunken men. They put their teeth into everything, swallowing things that even the filthiest animal would not touch. Finally, they devoured even the belts and shoes and gnawed on the leather of their shields. That's how bad it got. And when the wall finally fell down, the Romans, Titus, at least history wants to make him out to be a pretty decent fellow, but the Roman soldiers were so upset with some of the things the Jews had done in fighting them, they actually just killed everybody left and right. Out of 1 million people, that some speculate, again, there you can find people that dispute that, but around 1 million people, they only 95,000 or so got saved for slavery. The rest were killed. And it said that in the temple, Wes talked about Jerusalem being set on a hill, and the temple was on a hill yet. And it said the temple was sort of the last place, one of the last place, strongholds. And it said they killed so many people there, they were actually just sliding down the hill, just bodies everywhere, I guess. And it's according to Josephus. And so that's what Christ was saying, yet I would suggest that that prophecy probably wasn't completely fulfilled with Jerusalem. I think Christ, in his foreknowledge, was likely giving us a glimpse, because then he mentions his second coming as well. So bringing this up to today, I don't know what troubles you, maybe the events, the actions of wicked people, national events, nation rising against nation, earthquakes, tornadoes, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just simply the wearing of daily life. But how should we as Christians today relate to troubling times in God's kingdom? What is a Christ-like response to such? You know, do we have a morbid fascination with the events and details, hashing and rehashing what we think we know, expounding our theories or proposing that theory or view, being quick to pass on tidbits that we find floating around to further angst and suspense. You know, I guess I am really troubled by it. I just had to think. I had the privilege of meeting one of the young ladies that I mentioned earlier, that's parents here recently. And, you know, as I look at how the Mennonite circle's related to that, how many of us actually were a blessing to them in their thing? You know, is talking about it, is trying to share the last bit of information really worthwhile? How many of us just took a couple days off to go pray and fast for them? I think something's a little out of whack in the way we relate to some of these things. Or when I'm discouraged, talk about what I face. Maybe it just seems sort of useless, sort of hopeless to really get anywhere. And so just give up, just go do my thing, allow a distraction to take over. So I'd like to look at what Christ told us to do in troubling times. If I ever thought my life was rough, it was nothing compared to what happened at Jerusalem. And we have seven things that Christ gave us to do in times like this. So please keep looking there at Luke chapter 21. So I'll just read over the seven. Just consider the things that Christ told us to do and the things he told us not to do. Number one is do not be deceived, verse 8. And he said, take heed that ye be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ. So be careful, don't be deceived, was the first thing he said. The second thing he says, do not be terrified, in verse 9. And when you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not yet, in my own words there. The third thing he says, in troubling times, be a testimony for Christ. That's in verse 13. And it shall turn to you for a testimony, and some of these I'll reword a little bit later on. And then the fourth thing he says not to do is do not premeditate your response, verse 14. Settle it therefore in your hearts not to meditate before what you shall answer. Don't roll it around your mind. Don't come up with conclusions. 5, verse 19, in patience possess ye your souls. In your patience possess you your souls. Then number 6 is be ready to flee. In verse 21 he says, then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out, and let them, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. Stay away from it. Be willing to flee. And then the seventh one is look up, lift up your heads, and I guess I'll use that as my title. Look up, lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. So number one, do not be deceived. If you look up that word deceived, it means do not roam from or wander from the truth. You know, as I look at it, and I'm talking to Mennonites for the most part, so when I think of our circles, you know, it's probably pretty rare for one of us just to turn 180 degrees and just walk away from the Bible just wholesale. I'm saying it never happens, but it's pretty rare. But what does happen a lot is people roam. They become distracted. They start reading this article, and I have many friends that this happened to. They read this, and pretty soon, over the course of 4 or 5 years, they end up way left field, if you want to say it that way. And you're like, what in the world are you doing? And they're proposing that we live on a flat earth and everything else, and they say it's in the Bible, and you can't reason, you can't talk with them. How did they get there? They roamed from the truth. That's quite frankly what they did. And you know, I think this begins when we begin chasing this thought and that idea, can we help but wander from the truth when we're not pursuing truth itself? It seems to me that many well-intentioned and well-meaning people got themselves crossways with the truth by needing to share a juicy bit here, find a little something new there. Sure, I have no intention of wandering from the truth, but the result is the same. We're no longer with truth when we begin that process. You know, all that conspiracy things and go around, I'm sure there's many things happening that many of us don't comprehend and don't understand. I accept that. At the same time, I don't even need to know. Why do I want to dig it out? Second, do not be terrified. If you look up the word terrified, it means basically don't fall. Do not be scared. Do not become inactive through fear. Do not let panic control you. Again, I'm not talking about any one of us intentionally doing the wrong thing or intentionally going astray. But when fear becomes our master, we make horrible decisions. And you can easily see that in other people. But what about myself? Remember, Christ did talk there, I think it's down verse 22, about men's heart failing them for fear. But that's not spoken in the context of a Christian. That's spoken about people that don't know Christ. You know, the distraction of fear causes us to go astray through a loss of focus on Christ. That should not be said of a Christian. We have a master that died to lift us above fear. Moving on to the third is be a testimony for Christ. There in verse 13, a different way of reading verse 13, if you have it there, is in these times shall be an occasion and an opportunity for you to testify of me. Now, I'm not saying maybe some of the sad happenings with some of the young ladies that I mentioned aren't maybe nationally known by our neighbors. But, you know, take the thing of COVID. Have you shared Christ more since COVID than you have before? You should have. There's been a lot more opportunity, hasn't there? I would say there has been, simply because men's heart failing them for fear. Where do we point them? How much more have I witnessed for Christ in the past year than I did the year before? If I haven't, it indicates that I'm not pointing people to Christ, because there's been ample opportunity. If nothing else, by simply just being still out there to help people whenever everybody was scared of everybody else. Huh? Okay, the fourth one is do not premeditate your response there in verse 14. Put that into my own words. Make a conscious choice to be at rest in your heart and do not try to decide beforehand what you should say in a difficult situation. So I want to be careful here. I'm no way think that Christ was promoting or saying that we should be lazy, right? Or that there's a lack of preparation. But the preparation he's speaking of is a preparation of trusting God rather than a preparation of figuring it out. You see the difference? How's that for you? So often I find myself at least trying to figure it out rather than having a preparation of trust. A preparation to trust God to guide, to direct. A preparation of, if I want to prepare, if I really want to do something, seek God rather than wise words. The fifth is in your patience possess you your souls. And I find the wording there interesting. I think we often say in patience possess your souls. But if you look at verse 19 with me, in your patience possess your souls. There's an extra your in there, isn't there? In your, or maybe I should say, in my cheerful endurance, acquire rest in my spirit and emotions. It's up to me to exercise patience. God isn't necessarily going to come down and be patient for me. That's a job he gave me to do. I need to exercise my patience. In my patience, possess my soul, my thoughts. Resting in God because of a choice I make, not because it's so easy or it looks like a great thing to do. Let me just ask you this. Does the way you relate to troubling times bring you peace and rest or fear and confusion? You know, we talked a little bit about that in Sunday school, didn't we? And I totally concur that if the way I relate to troubling times brings more fear and confusion to my heart, then it's not of God. No matter what you face, no matter what's happening around us, if we're relating to it in the way that God wants us to relate to, it brings peace and rest in spite of the unrest around us. Going on to six, be ready to flee. Maybe that's one, I think that's one that's almost foreign to us to consider. I am no way, like I said, I'd be totally defeating the purpose I'm speaking here if I was fear-mongering. But I think as Christians, sometimes we need to be ready to move on. Be ready to flee. You know, troubling times separate the professing Christian from the real Christian like nothing else can or does. And I just had to think of it this way. If I've surrendered and given all to Christ, if everything that is in my possession, so to speak, is held by an open hand, it's not mine, but his, guess what? If there does come a time that I need to flee, there's nothing to hold me back, is there? It's when things are mine that I'm stuck. You know, if the time comes to flee, the true Christian is in the best of shape. He or she will already have given it all to Christ. And so if what he tells them to do is run, actually all you have to do is run, right? You don't have to go figure a lot of things out, a lot of business entanglements. They'll be ready to go. And I know this was in the old covenant, but I had to think of Lot and Sodom. You're welcome to disagree with me here, but I think the reason Lot was spared when Sodom was judged was because of Abraham rather than because of Lot. I don't know what you think. I do know that in the New Testament it talks about just Lot. So I'm not saying that he had lost everything good. I'm not saying he was like Sodom necessarily in saying that. But as you look at the decisions he had made that took him to Sodom, and then the things that happened while he left Sodom and afterwards, it seems to me that Lot had slid pretty far from where God could be pleased with him. And then what his wife did, she evidently was entangled. And thinking about that, how's it with me? Has Sodom, or maybe I shouldn't say Sodom, or have the things that Sodom has gotten a hold of me? I come back to that old saying, I know I've told you some of that before, but the more things you own, the more things own you. And I'm not sure how to get rid of all my things. I probably wouldn't be wise with a family to support and all, but I still like to think about the thought. I mean, do I just get things because I can? Or do the things I have at least serve a purpose, and I'm willing to let them go if they no longer serve that purpose? And here's an interesting thing to think about. So we're talking about Jews and the destruction of Jerusalem, and where the Christians just had to leave it, whether it was a house, whether it was whatever. They had a short window where those Roman soldiers withdrew and they could just get out if they believed what Christ said. And you know, if what he says is true, that not one Christian was in Jerusalem at its destruction, people believed took Christ pretty serious, didn't they? As 40 years later. Do I take Christ that serious today? Just willing to walk away from it all because I believe what he said is going to happen. And talking of Jews, this happened more recently, and I enjoy history. And one thing I've read quite a bit about is World War II, which I guess it's getting further and further removed from us, but wasn't that long ago. My dad was born partway through it, so I have sort of a connection, if you will, to it in that way. And you know what always amazed me is Hitler and his campaign against the Jews in Germany and Europe. You know, they got meaner and meaner to these people. First it was, I forget what all the steps were, but you know, first they were told to wear this six-pointed star, and then they couldn't ride on the buses. And anyway, he progressively was definitely clear he was on a bad trajectory towards Jews, and yet millions of Jews stayed in that situation. And I'm sure it would be awful hard just to go out in my vehicle and head for Mexico right now. I mean, I'm not trying to fault anybody, but there was some that left, and I've read of some that left and some that didn't. And it's, you know, the reasons that people didn't leave is, well, they just thought it couldn't get worse. It couldn't get bad, and they basically didn't believe information that was right in front of their own nose. And, you know, to me, it speaks loudly that I'm sure the reason there was, if there was that amount, 500,000 to a million Jews inside Jerusalem, they all had equal opportunity as the Christians to escape. But the reason they stayed is it looked like maybe they were going to win, right? So the Romans are here and they pull back. And so rather than believing God, if you will, Christ's words, they stayed put thinking that maybe this is going to work out for good. We're going to have it made. Anyway, just some thoughts. Am I ready to flee, to just leave behind? And to take steps. I think maybe, anyway, we could go a long time on that. Okay, the last one. Last point is look up, lift up your heads. And I guess I like that thought of look up. If you look that up in Strong's, it says the reverse of being bowed down is actually what it says, is the Greek. This Greek word, sort of reverse word. So look up, it's the reverse of being bowed down. Be straightened, lose weight, be elated, raise your head with joy. You're reaching the end of the journey. And I would like to suggest to you that as natural men, when we face difficult times, troubling times, unsettled times, we have a couple directions we tend to look, but up isn't one of them. We tend to look down to watch our feet. We try to, if so to speak, we try to navigate our way through these troubling times. We try to use what we think we know, and we try to steer a path between the rocks, looking down. That's one natural place to look. Another place that's natural to look is off to the right or to the left. What are others doing? What do others have? And that can be done in multitudes of ways. Maybe I try to be like some other people. Maybe I try to do what I see others doing. Well, guess what? When those Christians left Jerusalem, they had to do it no matter what their neighbors were doing, right? And so just today, looking to the right hand, to the left, doesn't really help me. Looking down, I think of being fearful, doubting, questioning, discouragement, and depression. Looking to the right and the left, I can think of, well, we could say politically for starters. Or we could say being distracted. Maybe I know that I need to wholeheartedly serve God, but I find it difficult to know how to do it, and so I allow myself to be distracted by business, by hobbies, by interests, by other values. And thinking of this, of look up, lift up your heads. Like Wes already told us this morning, you know, Jerusalem was on a hill, and then the temple was on a hill inside Jerusalem. And so it was a focal point. You looked up. Yet in all the troubles that came in that place, look, you know, just looking at Jerusalem, just looking at the temple, didn't solve anyone's problems. We have to look beyond that, to look at Christ, to look up, truly up. And in thinking of looking up, I love the mental image of a traveler who's walked a long, hard road to reach a highly anticipated place. You know, as that destination comes in sight and he catches his first glimpse of it, weariness seems to disappear as he drops everything and gazes with excitement and then run towards it, towards his destination, forgetful of the weary feet and the miles they have gone. You know, can it be said of me, as it was said of the Christians in Jerusalem, that not one of them got mixed up in this? Not one. How did they avoid it? Was it not by believing and focusing on Christ? When these things come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. Let's kneel for prayer.